This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
When you're good to mama, mama's good to you.
I turn to you like a flower leaning toward the sun. I turn to you, 'cause you're the only one.
And when I fall down, I have to pick myself back up.
This is Stand Up Straight on Joy 94.9.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome. I am Michelle Barber, and you are listening to Stand Up Straight, where we aim to provide a vehicle for the straight allied supporters to stand up for our GLBTI communities, to encourage and create greater inclusion, share stories, give advice, create dialogue, or even introduce a new way of thinking. But most importantly, we want to facilitate change towards greater acceptance of our rainbow family in all its shapes and sizes. You're also listening to Stand Up Straight in Sydney on Star Observer Digital, your sex, sexuality and gender diverse digital radio station. Hi, Sydneysiders. So tonight, guys, I am joined with somebody that has a massive resume. He is an anti-homophobia campaigner, an author, an educator, founder of Niche, and he has coined the phrase, tackling homophobia one cuppa at a time. Daniel Whithouse, welcome.
Thank you.
Describe you aptly enough?
Oh, sure. It always makes me kind of nervous when I hear all of those things because I kind of forget sometimes about the things that I do and have done. And yeah.
Really? Should it be longer list?
Oh, no. So to give you an example, I've got some friends at the moment who are calling me an author and I've just gone, oh, I really don't feel like one. And they've said, how many books do you want to write before you feel like one? So it's getting used to it.
Bit humbling, is it a little bit?
Oh, look, after spending so much time writing a book, I think anyone knows working on any project at all, to finally have it published is kind of, quite, for me, has been quite overwhelming because, there are many long nights where I'm kind of, burning the midnight oil going, what am I doing this for? Will it ever actually get out there to the public? And now that it's kind of sitting on shelves is kind of makes me giddy sometimes.
Is that a bit insane? You walk into a shop and you see it there. Do you want to say to people, hey, that's me.
I've actually become very scared to go into bookshops because I don't think I want to know. But what's been really great is that because Facebook is so fantastic and I've got so many people who have supported me over so many years, when they see it, they take photos. So I've got all these photos coming up on Facebook going, we saw your book here, there, it was at the airport, it was out in bloody suburban Hobart or wherever it is. That's lovely. So I know that it's getting out there.
Do you know what we haven't done is mention the name of it.
It's called Beyond Priscilla, One Gay Man, One Gay Truck and One Big Idea.
I've had that highlighted. I love that.
And it's the story of me driving around the country for 266 days, challenging homophobia one cuppa at a time with an absolute focus on regional, rural and remote Australia. I think that many times when LGBTI stuff happens in Australia, we often think about Melbourne, Sydney and maybe sometimes Perth and Brisbane. And this was really about getting to every nook and cranny in all those places that don't necessarily get a Guernsey.
Mm. Mm. And that's something that I really want to talk a lot more about as we progress through the hour. Wanted to a little bit of a background, tiny little bit of the Daniel Whithouse growing up story. What was your family like? Was it anything out of the ordinary?
Sure. Look, I grew up in the city by the bay, Geelong, in the Bronx, Norlan Kariah, for anyone. Every time I mention that to people, they go, oh, my God, you didn't grow up there. My father was a policeman there, which was really interesting in terms of the way that we interacted as a family with the community there. And who turned up on our doorstep. Mum kind of was odd jobs and cleaner and things like that. And I grew up with an older brother and sister, and I think it was a fairly suburban, beige kind of existence. And so kind of by the time I kind of hit university and started, you know, travelling around the world, all of a sudden, you know, there was lots of colour and movement, and I wanted to be a part of that, and off I went.
That's a very, very abridged version. Going back a bit, did you ever have any kind of, was there a social justice theme ever in your family? Did you, was there community work or volunteering or anything like that that was ever?
Look, I think what really drives my work is really interestingly the way that my mother approached the world. So I was very close with my mother, and yes, for the stereotype, I'm a mummy's boy. But look, you know, mum, I just had this incredible way, and still does with people. She always thinks that if there's an issue, you actually have a cuppa with someone, mm-hmm. and you sit down and you have a chat, which is where my kind of one cup at a time strategy comes from. But you know, the way that she looks at life is that you approach everybody and expect their best. And if something happens, then, you know, if something happens and you're not happy with that, then that's a different story. But always leave the assumptions aside and treat people, you know, as they are, as you see them and how they treat you. And really, I guess if that's a social justice thing, I don't think it was kind of, I thought, human rights or anything like that. It was just, you know, I wanted to interact with people, help them, do my best. And it just so happened that there was more that I could do than I actually thought.
Mm.
Yeah.
And I bet if you had to have cast your mind 10, 15 years ahead, you would never have imagined, I would think, that you would be doing and have achieved what you've achieved then. Is it something that, was there ever any discussion about a path, do you think it maybe in your later teens, about a path that you wanted to kind of travel down?
Well, growing up, I was always obsessed with the Atlas and also things about the planets and the stars. And I was determined to become an astronomer, not an astrologer, an astronomer. Yeah. So my dad, when I was in grade six, said, you can't get any bloody jobs being an astronomer. You know, it's a closed shop. So he decided that I was going to be an Air Force pilot. And for 6 years, I was going to be. And all my studies, I went for scholarships with the Defence Forces, et cetera, et cetera. But when I hit 18 and I came out, and I at that stage I thought, I can't be in the Defence Forces and be gay and look at things now. but what that did was made me think about, well, what is it that you want to do? And that's when I turned to psychology, and I think it's that background with my mother and how she treats people that I thought, for some reason when I was growing up, everyone wanted to come and talk to me and get me to listen and, you know, say, can you help or can you listen? And I actually enjoyed that. I didn't enjoy some of the stuff that was happening to the people around me, but that was something I felt was kind of a natural thing for me. And so psychology was a bit of a pathway, and that's what led me into volunteering the LGBTI communities, and off I went.
Mm. And down in Geelong, you came out, you said, at 18?
Yeah,
in that area.
Yep.
How were you received? General question, I know, but just we're trying to get a bit of a background.
Look, overwhelmingly, the people who I interacted with, it was positive. But you know, I think that I wouldn't be alone in that. There were lots of people who suddenly just dropped off the radar and didn't kind of keep in contact. But like I say, the people, I mean, I was turning 18, I was leaving school behind, and I was moving into different circles in life. So I mean, that happens naturally. Mm. But I definitely think a little bit of it was people didn't necessarily know how to approach me, and there was always this kind of thing, this cloud, for this rainbow cloud following me around all through high school, that, you know, I was probably gay.
I like that terminology, rainbow cloud.
Yeah.
You see it,
and instead of rain, there's glitter that falls from it.
Naturally,
you know?
Would it be anything else? That's a given.
But sure, look, I did have that experience throughout high school, and so I had a lot of people who rallied around me. You know, I guess for that generation, it was very stereotypical. It was girls. It was the females in my family. The blokes didn't necessarily know what to do.
On that, did that kind of give you a bit of a sense of, well, hey, I'm going to try and win them over, you know, you're saying that the women supported you
yep.
straight away. Did that happen with the men?
Oh, look, my brother told my sister when he found out that he wanted to come and beat the bejesus out of me. My father, I had to leave home
straight away,
my father's. Yeah, absolutely, before I came out. And that was the family's decision because they thought that something bad would happen.
Was that
to
like
me.
a family decision they thought for your well being?
So as I progressively came out, everyone said, I felt differently about it, but that decision, you know, back then was taken out of my hands because people were concerned for my safety. Mm. And, you know, I appreciate that. But I think I had a sense that it could be different. And but I left home and it was kind of all a bit messy. And but that was, you know, again, what I think I learned from that is that, you know, people operate with the best of intent. It doesn't necessarily the outcome isn't always what you want it to be. You'd like people to do things differently, but people were operating with the best of intent. They wanted the best outcome for me and my safety and all the rest of it. So, you know, I can't begrudge them that, especially in an area like this back, you know, what was it, 20 years ago or so, when you know, there was a lot less kind of known about, you know, and a lot less visibility.
So I wonder then, even perhaps, and this goes into my big question that I want to ask you, is that I wonder if then on a subliminal level that is what was the springboard for what was going to happen for the, you know, so far in your life. And I'm wondering then, because my big question to you is, how do you, there's dictionary definitions of what homophobia is, but how do you describe it?
So there are a couple of questions there.
I know.
So the first one would be whether what experience I had, whether that drove me to do what I do. Look, I think that over the years, the way I've described it and come to think about it is that it's informed the stuff that I do. Mm. You know, it definitely informs, and it's in the back of my mind about this is how I experienced it. But I think that if people are going to have longevity in working in the LGBTI communities, and I've been lucky enough to work in the area for 18 years, I think you have to put your own stuff aside and realize that not everyone has your experience.
Yeah.
I often find that people come into the field and they've got kind of an idea about, well, this happened to me, so if this happens, everything will be fine, or we need to do this. And for me, although it informs what I do, I'm very, very clear that lots of people have very different experiences to me, both good and bad. Mm. And you know, the early work that I did in the first couple of years when I was working with the then Gay and Lesbian Project, because there was only GNL back in those days, Gay and Lesbian Youth Support Project, and it was the stories that I heard from those young people that actually drove me to do something. And this is how I try to explain it to people, is that when I was growing up, my self-esteem and self-worth was pretty low. It was pretty, you know, on the floor. So for me to arrogantly think that my experience should mean that I want to change the world because of what happened to me, that wasn't even a fact. It was like, who cares about me and what do I mean to the world and who cares? It was more that when I started working with young people, it was I wanted to do something for them. Mm. And it's not to say that my own stuff wasn't in there, but it was very, very focused on, well, I've got to do something for them. Now, the interesting thing is that what I wanted to do for those young people was to make life better for them or their individual school. I never set out for all of this to kind of explode the way that it has. So as you said, casting my mind 15 or 20 years down the track, I just thought if I can do something in the next kind of 6 to 12 months, it's going to make life better for the young people who I come and see every week, rather than saying, I'll cross my fingers and I hope that next week you won't have as many bad stories about all the stuff that's happening to you at school. Then I would feel better, you know, I'd feel better about the world. And then all of a sudden it just kept going and going. And I'm one of these people. I think that this is both a blessing and a curse, is that I'll always say yes to everything.
You're a people pleaser, I'm taking it.
well, look, in terms of I'm a person who likes to make the most of an opportunity. And it's either I can sit home and, you know, watch something on TV, or I can go out there and give something a go. I know what I'm going to do. And yeah, 9 times out of 10, hopefully.
Have you had to justify why challenging home homophobia is so vital? Have you had to kind of explain to people why this is so big?
Look. I think for me, when I'm speaking to, because look, the interesting thing is that that's why I'm really interested and happy that I've come on this show, is that the majority of people I've worked with over the last 18 years have been mainstream communities. It's really interesting. Like I do, the last couple of years has been interesting. I've done more work in the LGBTI communities, but really I'm going out there to local governments, to schools, to community organizations, to rural towns where you know, I'm often the first person who they've spoken to professionally about something like this. So for me, it's about people feel that something needs to be done, but it's how to make it relevant to them in their everyday life. So I'm a teacher. What's it got to do with me? What's it going to mean for me in my classroom tomorrow? That's my job, you know. Or whether it's I'm in an aged care facility, I haven't seen a gay or lesbian person or whatever, or we did 5 years ago but they left for the big smoke or whatever it is, that this is my challenge, is to get that message across about how this is relevant for them and what they can do.
So when we come back, you're going to tell me how you might have been able to achieve that in some of the schools, some of the discussions that you might have had with the students, and maybe some helpful hints as we get through the hour as well. Yeah. So you are on Stand Up Straight on Joy 94.9.
You're listening to Michelle on Stand Up Straight on Joy 94.9. She's my mum.
Hi, everyone. You are on Joy 94.9. You're with Michelle and Daniel Whithouse, and we're having a chat to him about his phenomenal life, and we're going to keep going along that same road. There's the link, the road. Get it? Your big national tour was called That's So Gay. Mm-hmm. Interesting title.
Yeah, look, my Beyond That So Gay tour was, I guess, an extension of the work that I've been doing over the years, not only in schools but also in regional, rural and remote areas, and actually came from an idea that happened with the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission of Australia. They did a project called Outlink in 1999 and 2000. And for those people who know Rodney Croom, who's now the convener of Australian Marriage Equality, Rodney spent some time in rural areas actually interviewing people and finding out what could be done and why so many young gay and bisexual young men were killing themselves in greater numbers than their heterosexual counterparts. And I was lucky enough to be picked, along with a number of other young people, by Rodney to actually sit on a kind of management committee for that project. That kind of fizzled away because there was a lack of resources and funding. But it got me thinking 10 years on. It was like, I wonder, because people often, you know, talk about it's better these days. You know, it's better these days. We know it is. But if we look at the stats and the anecdotes, that doesn't necessarily mix up. There's something going on there. So my idea was, okay, I'm going to go for a drive. I'm not going to go to, you know, here and there and come back to Melbourne and go out again. I'm going to drive around the whole thing, go to every single state and territory, not miss anywhere, go to all the places where people say don't go, and find out. And my job, as I saw it, was to go to all those areas and find out what they had to say. So rather than me sit in Melbourne or Sydney and go, here's how it is in rural Australia for people, for LGBTI people, my job was to go out and to get them to tell me and tell their stories and say what they think is going on. So the idea was to get this modern day snapshot about what LGBTI life is like in Australia. So I went to the capital cities and did interviews and things and events there too. But it was about, you know, what is it like in people's own words? And I think, you know, I got a pretty clear picture.
Did you speak to parents as well? At all, yeah. So, look.
The idea was for me to rock up into every single place, spend a week there. So it was 38 weeks. Spend a week in each location and to talk to anyone who wanted to cuppa, and I mean anyone. And so what often people thought, in the beginning people thought, oh, you're just a gay boy and you're going to drive around and talk to gay people and, you know, fag hags. That was what most people thought. Probably 2/3 of the people I spoke to were mainstream heterosexual Australia, people who'd never had this conversation professionally, sometimes not even personally before. And that was really because I thought, well, yes, I want to know about things from LGBTI people, but we've done a lot of research. We've heard those stories before. What we haven't done is we haven't heard from mainstream Australia what gets them excited, interested, peeved off, engaged, empowered, whatever that is. I wanted to know what that was because there's not enough work that's done there. And like I said, that's where I've spent most of my time for the last two decades is actually working with those people because I want to get outside of the bubble.
So did you find, so as far as their response and their reaction, were they just raring to go and or did it kind of take a little while before you broke down some barriers?
Yeah, look, most places I went, there was people ended, by the end of the week, people were saying it's about bloody time, it's so refreshing, thank goodness. But when I rocked up into town, look, it takes a while to break into a country community, to be an outsider. People think, oh, this is some gay guy from the Big Smoke coming in to smack us and tell us we're wrong and we're homophobic. And but soon, you know, throughout Cuppers, people realised I was chatting to them and I was asking them questions and trying to find out their perspectives. And then people would then warm up. In terms of whether people were raring to go, most places no. But the interesting thing was is that all people needed was the permission and an excuse to get going, and then they wouldn't shut up. It was fantastic.
Was it one-on-one ever?
It was my weeks generally started one-on-one. So I'd get into town, I'd Google things like youth services, police stations, hospitals, community centres, counselling, so anything that where they work with people, and just cold called and said, hi, I'm here in town for a week, I'm doing this project, have you got time, 15, 20 minutes for a cuppa? And then what they then did was said, come in and have a cuppa. Now, in those one-to-ones, sometimes they'd go, I'm bringing in my mate or other staff members. And other times, you know, I'd rock into town, they'd say, well, quick, can you go into this school on Thursday? You know, in a couple of days' time or whatever that is. So every town was different in that
is
regard.
Is it the biggest social issue in schools at the moment, do you think?
Schools would say differently, would think differently.
The official statement, you mean?
The official thing, I would ask young people themselves. That's where I'd go to. And if you look at the last couple of National Youth Roundtables and all the young people and what they're saying, they'd say that homophobia is in the top three. And the other big one for them is bullying, and drugs and alcohol. However, if you look at the research, you've got kind of eminent people like Dr. David Plummer, for example, in Sydney, and he says that homophobia is over 50% of all bullying. Now, if we've got all of these bullying programs that are happening and actually, you know, the bulk majority of them don't even raise homophobia or even address it.
Why?
I think that's, you know, possibly got to do with people's own bias. They just think it's bullying and we just got to deal with bullying generally. Like, don't make people feel uncomfortable. The other thing is I think that they're quite, you know, understandably, a lot of people think that if you get onto this topic, that, you know, kids are going to run around with their hair on fire and throw chairs through the windows and, you know, the roof's going to cave in and then today, tonight's going to run down the street with cameras and parents are going to pitchfork the, you know, and pick at the school. So lots of people go, look, we'll just stick with bullying. But if we're not dealing with homophobia in those bullying programs, then we've missed a huge chunk, the biggest chunk.
Then all those GLBTI kids at those schools are not being validated, are they?
No, and look, often we do hear about the abuse and harassment that goes on, and that's been well documented by, for example, La Trobe University, and they're writing themselves in series. But in terms of the big issue that people talk about is that yes, there's that kind of abuse and harassment, but they talk about the visibility stuff. They just go, just, you know, give it a mention, like talk about it every now and then, say something, and you know, and I know that this is changing, but I don't think it's changed as much as people would believe. But you know, when I was working with young people for the first decade of my career, what young people were saying to me was, you know, I went to school and they'll talk about it being like this bleak grey kind of desert. And then they'd talk about one moment in their entire school career where one teacher said something mildly supportive. Sometimes it was just talking about social justice. Sometimes it was a poster. Sometimes it was a rainbow sticker, whatever it might be. And they'll talk about it as if it's this oasis in the desert. They'll talk about how it made them feel
and
how
it was for them
and how it sustained them. And how it sustained them. And I I take that message back to teachers now when they go, look, it's all too big and scary. What is it that one teacher or one person can do? And I know for a fact that young people, you know, have said, still say to this day, there was one teacher. It meant that I could go into that classroom and I could have, you know, one period off for the week. I could go to the art room at lunchtime. I could go to the school canteen, wherever that might be in the school. There were always, you know, these pockets that young people would talk about. And for me, I thank goodness that they're there. Now, would I like things to be different? Would I like it to be broader? Yes. But to think that one person can't make a huge, huge difference in a young person's life, I disagree with them very strongly.
Was that kind of surprising that you would think, as educators, that they would not have even thought of those types of things? That might be a naive question from me, but I would have thought that that would be an instinctive or intuitive thing.
One of the things which I think is really, really interesting is that most of the schools I spoke to said, look, we don't have any of those kids here. Now I know that everyone says that there are young people all over Australia exploding out of closets in clouds of glitter and rainbows. People have this idea that it's happening in all schools everywhere, and the majority of the schools, because I was going to any old school, it wasn't like go to this one because they're going lesbian friendly, whatever that is. I'd go to any school, the overwhelming majority of them said, we don't have these young people here, but if they came out to us, then we'd do something about it. So I think that this is really interesting. There's this onus of they've got to come out, they've got to be visible.
Then we'll address it.
Then we'll do something about it, and because that's when they're most at risk. And what I talk to teachers about is that if you look at the suicide research, it says that in the months leading up to when young people come out for the first time to someone is the most at-risk time. If you're saying that we're doing this because it's the most at-risk time once they come out, that's actually
too
not.
And is it, you know, too late in a little bit late?
Well, it might be, and you know, but in terms of what the research says, it says do stuff before young people come out, because and we know too that even though we do have young people coming out, most young people won't be coming out in schools as it stands right now around the country.
Is it different in rural areas than in the city?
Look, I think that the city areas have more in common than they do have more in common with regional and rural Australia than people think. I've heard stories of, you know, young women being in relationships and holding hands, you know, in rural and regional schools. I've heard of young men coming out in you know, but I've also heard about suburban metro schools where nothing's happening, you know, and this isn't raised. And for me, it's about starting the conversation. If I go into a school and I say, is there any homophobia here? They'll go, well, no gay kids had their head kicked in, so no.
Oh,
and besides, we don't have gay kids anyway. Oh, no, we had one 5 years ago, but he moved to the big smoke, so, you know, like, we hope he's okay. So that's where the idea of that's so gay comes into it. So if I go into a school and I go, a kid saying that's so gay, because lots of other schools are saying that's the case, they go, oh my God, it is. We're pulling our hair out. We don't know what to do. Should we say something? Should we not? And then all of a sudden, that's a starting point for a conversation. Mm. It's like, you know, when people go, well, why do you use homophobia? It's such a laden kind of, you know, emotive word, and you could be using this one and that one. It's a starting point.
Yeah.
You know, when I think about, you know, heteronormativity and a whole bunch of other stuff, like a lot of other people do. But when I'm going out to, you know, a police officer in Port Lincoln in South Australia, if I start talking about heteronormativity and heterosexism, I'm going to have a tougher time than if I say, what is it that you know? Let's build on that.
So is it about getting it, cliche, but is it that first foot in the door? How wet, whatever that word is, that terminology, or even your demeanour, I would think. If you can't be abrasive when you're talking to people, you've got to want them to talk to you, don't you?
Absolutely. Yeah. I have to, and like a lot of people do. I mean, people do it, you know, all the time. Is, you know, sometimes I have to take a deep breath, bite my tongue.
Yeah.
But the thing is that what I'm mindful of, which a lot of people are, and I had some mentors who taught me really, really well with this, is that, you know, if someone asks a stupid question or says something that you know, isn't great, realize that, you know, it's the first time, or, you know, it could be clunky with them, and just and take it from that point of view. And so when I'm talking to people, that's my responsibility, is to say, think about where they're at, and by the end of one cuppa, I want them to be in a different place that's a little step further than when I actually, you know, it's like this campsite rule. I want to leave the campsite better than the way in which I found it, you know, and go from there.
Thank you, Daniel. We are on... Michelle is talking with Daniel Whithouse, and you are on Stand Up Straight on Joy 94.9.
J To find out more about Joy 94.9, check out joy.org.au.
Be an ally. Talk it out. Educate yourself. Stand up straight on Joy 94.9. Hi, you are with Michelle and Daniel, and we're having a chat, a little wee bit of a chair dance, I think, as well.
Sorry, I just, yeah.
No, you're allowed.
I cannot believe how good the music is for your intro and all the, like, yeah, anyway. Congrats.
No, thank you, thank you. I do love my music, I do have to say. Wondering whether you, in your travels, have come across anybody that's actually been homophobic to you or you know, a bit cruel, whatever, anything at all?
Yeah, one of the stories I tell in my new book, Beyond Priscilla, is where's it
available?
Available in all good bookshops. Great. Especially we love in Melbourne, Hares and Hyenas, and it's available on the World Wide Webs and all that kind of stuff. If you go to things like Amazon and stuff like that, and also Clouds of Magellan is my publisher.
And we'll
go to their website. But in there, I describe about Kaiguna petrol station, which is a remote petrol station. Anyone who has driven across the Nullarbor probably has either seen Kaiguna slip past very quickly, or they've stopped in because they need petrol, because otherwise they're going to run out and die in the heat. So I stopped in Kaiguna petrol station and had a run-in with a couple of truckers who were decided that they, I think, probably because they were bored, and decided I had a little bit too much colour and movement at the counter when I was paying for my petrol, and off they went. I described that, and there was an okay outcome in the end. But look, that was pretty much it for the tour. Like I describe it as, I'm the challenging homophobia guy. Now most people are going to avoid, I imagine, saying something to the gay guy who's a bit mouthy, and who'll see it as I kind of see it as a blood sport if someone wants to have a go. And the other thing is, and this point has been made, is that people say that the way that I look is that I look a little bit like I might rip someone's head off and crap down their neck. Who knows? I think if we're all pushed enough, we could do that kind of thing. But look. The people are. One of the things that I've experienced is that over the years is that homophobia is cowardly. It's opportunistic and cowardly, and when people think that they can get away with it and they're not going to get any blowback, they'll do it. Now, with me, that kind of sometimes can be different. If I'm the gay guy who's coming to town to do this tour, people go, oh, well, who are we going to pick on? We're going to pick on someone smaller or, you know, whatever. The interesting thing for me, which has been tough, especially when I was living in Geelong, is that my family and friends actually got a lot of blowback. And even when I started working in local government areas in these kinds of projects, the people around me, including my managers, my teammates, were the ones who were getting the flak for the work I was doing, and had some heat turned up on them. And that infuriated me, because I felt helpless and powerless, because I was like, well, come at me. Come and ask me the questions, or give me the heat. I'm the one that's doing the work. And, you know, especially when it comes to, you know, I have no idea how many conversations my family have had on my behalf. I mean, my mother would burst into tears, because she's like as proud as anything about me.
As she should be.
But I know that she talks about me a lot, but, you know, it makes me wonder about the people around me. And I realize that that's a cost, and that, you know, I would say that, should I be saying this publicly, that's my kryptonite, really, you know.
Do you think we would ever get rid of homophobia?
If we look at utopia and how far away it is, it's a long way off. If we look at what's happened with racism and sexism, and where we're at, I would argue that we have a long way to go in both of those areas. But we've had legislation change and a lot of kind of movement, and if people talk about it on the surface in Australia, apparently everything's okay. I think that if we, you know, had a whole raft of things like marriage equality and a whole bunch of other stuff happening, we'd still have a hangover for, if we look at racism and sexism, for another 3 to 4 decades. So that's a long way. Now, I'm hopeful that there's a lot we can do with minimal investment, but in the meantime, we need to just say, look, here's what we need to do. We need to kind of put one foot in front of the other and deal with the stuff now, rather than waste too many trees on, you know, writing about what it could be.
Has there been any particular stories that touch you more than, or conversations or experiences that touch you more than others? Was there any kind of emotional experiences?
Look, for me, the stories that I remember on tour are the ones where, I had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cuppers. I spoke to so many people, stared into their eyes, heard about what homophobia meant to them or the experience that they had, heard their life stories. For me, the stories that stand out is when just someone says something that crystallizes what, 50 other people have said, and they just say it in a way that sums it up all perfectly. One of the ones, for example, is, there's a young man who I describe called Jack, and Jack lives in Port Lincoln in South Australia. And he talks about how he has everything that he could ever want. He's got his family who are supportive. He's got his friends. He's got a job that he really enjoys. He loves being in, the town that he's in. He kind of says that he thinks that he's a bad gay, because he said, I can't dress for shit, and I don't know, I like cars and all the rest of it. So he'll talk about, that. But the thing that he says is, look, the one piece of the puzzle that's missing is actually the fact that I don't have a boyfriend. And if I had a boyfriend, I would have absolutely everything. But I don't want to leave Port Lincoln, but I think I'm going to have to. I think I'm going to have to go to Adelaide, because I need this thing in my life. Mm. I need to kind of, to find that, as I imagine, is not too uncommon. And so, for me, that's an example of a story that stands out. There's another young woman who lives in rural WA, and Minnie is and she actually became a cartoon for a series that I did with the Your Story campaign. But Minnie talks about how she came out to her grandmother on Facebook. Her grandmother told her to get on Facebook.
Gosh.
Her grandmother, and she said, "Look, I'm sorry, I'm gay, Nan." And Nanny turned around and said, "You got nothing to be sorry for, I love you." And she's saying, I don't want to leave where I'm at.
We are going to take just a really quick break and come back and chat a little bit more with Daniel Whithouse. Hi everyone, you are on Joy 94.9. You're with Michelle and Daniel Whithouse, and we've had a fabulous message in from a lovely Emma. Loving the building on what's already there concept and positive reinforcement attitude from Daniel. Great discussion. As a senior manager, I will be able to use some of the tips in the workplace. I often get asked questions about my sister who is gay, and funnily enough, they are often when we are in the tea room having a cuppa and chatting. Great ideas. Well, there you go, Daniel.
That's great. And look, one of the things is a lot of people think that most of my work kind of happens in schools and rural areas, and they forget that I also do work in workplaces as well. So I've done a lot of LGBTI inclusiveness stuff in different organisations, and everything from kind of aged care, customer service, retail, a whole bunch of other places that's just not about community services. And I think it's that idea about how can I make it relevant for the people in their everyday roles, because otherwise they're just going to grumble at me and think that I've wasted their time.
Have you ever felt, I probably know the answer, but have you ever felt that you would give up, or it's too hard, this mountain is so hard to climb scenario?
I'll let you in on a secret. I'm kind of approaching this as a very complex social experiment game, and so I'm kind of pushing it and keep on saying yes and doing things until all of a sudden I can't do anything anymore.
So you're out of a job.
So I just I'm kind of going along the way and trying everything I can. Does it feel too much? The only time it did actually climb on top of me was before I went and lived in Berlin for the first time. I found that when people were asking me those questions that I was talking about before, they were asking me the same old questions. And I noticed myself feeling a little bit grumpy. And it just kept on coming for a couple of months. And I went, if I'm feeling a little bit grumpy, eventually this is going to kind of eke out. And if people are coming to me with the best of intent and asking those same questions we know, then that's not going to be the greatest thing. So I actually took myself off for a sabbatical to Berlin for a year and wrote my first book.
Wow.
And then have come back, and I haven't hit that grumpy stage just yet.
Hopefully it's a long, long time off, and there's a lot more books too.
Yeah.
What would you advise teenage? I've gone back and forward a little bit. What would you advise teenagers to say if they're hearing it and seeing it in the schoolyard, for instance?
Oh, look. Always checking with their own safety, their safety and support. But look, if one of the most powerful things with That's So Gay is teachers do have a role to play. You know, adults do have a role to play. However, the most powerful thing is when other students stand up and say, that's not okay. Mm. And people think that they have to have an elaborate comeback.
And it can be simple as that, isn't it? That's, you know, not cool.
Hey, that's not okay. Or I've got someone I know, or you know, there are other people here and it's not okay here. And that is one of the most powerful messages. And when you can get, you know, I've often worked in schools and young people say, what can we do? And the schools, they've said, where as a student body after doing this workshop are going to go out and do stuff. That's when I get excited, because I know that that's when... when they've turned a corner of sorts.
And I think that perhaps they try and overcomplicate it, the teachers. Maybe the kids have got the answers a lot more.
Sure. You know? Well, but you know, and also the other thing I'd say to teenagers, and you know, the other thing, and people who are supporting them, is to think about the support around people. The difference between young people who are thriving and barely surviving in every nook and cranny of this country was if they had five supportive people around them. So that's really a goal that I think is that if everyone, we can get everyone with five supportive people around them, we will be in a remarkably different place.
I would agree. Do you think you're a role model?
That makes me sweat and get, it's like when it's okay. People call me an author and stuff. If what I do gets people excited and gets them motivated and they think, hang on, you know, if he can bloody do it, I can do it too. That makes me a happy man.
Yeah. Well, you've made me a happy woman having you in the studio tonight. I have learnt a lot, and I hope people out there have listened and learnt a lot as well. You're an amazing, inspirational person, and I hope you realise that. And I would love to have you come back and tell us what you're doing in the future. Thank you, Daniel, for joining me tonight.
Yeah, thank you, and I'd love to be back.
Be lovely to see you again. Coming up next, we've got Spirit Lounge with Joy and a new co-host, Tal. Leaving you with your weekly challenge, which is, what will you do this week to stimulate dialogue, create change, or encourage involvement? You have been listening to Michelle Barber on Stand Up Straight on Joy 94.9.
Straight has a podcast, so check it out at the Joy website, joy.org.au.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.